Yeah, that's a really powerful question.
That's a beautiful question.
That is a very wise question, Lauren.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported in part by Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, and this is the first half of my conversation with Diane K. Boyd, one of the first female biologists in the United States to study wild wolves in their natural habitat. She's also the author of A Woman Among Wolves, My Journey Through 40 Years of Wolf Recovery. This is the story of Diane's passion, her resilience, and determination. A Woman Among Wolves documents the early days of wolf research, as well as the present-day challenges of wolf management across the globe, highlighting Diane's interactions with an apex predator that captured her heart and her undying admiration. Diane, thank you so much for joining me. Welcome to The Right Question.
Thanks. I'm excited to be here, Lauren. Thanks so much.
I'm so excited to have you here. Let's start with a really basic, at least on the surface, a basic question. What appealed and appeals to you, even at a young age, about wolves?
Well, I grew up in Minnesota, and it was the only state when I was a kid that had wolves. There was a handful of, you know, I don't know, 25 or so in Isle Royale, and there really weren't any anywhere else. And then eventually in the 70s, they started trying to tiptoe into Wisconsin. And so there was this mythology, northern Minnesota wolves, the wilderness, the Boundary Waters canoe area. And I just was fascinated by it. And I was denied having a dog all my years growing up. And I had this hunger for canid, canid connection. And then I got my first dog when I was about 15, but it just continued. And then Dave Meach, who's the godfather of wolf science. I mean, he's amazing. He's still working, and I think he's like 86.
Wow.
His office was on my St. Paul campus. And so I just dropped by and kept bugging him and letting him know, I really want to study wolves. Just really naive. But anyway, that connection paid off, and here I am.
The rest is in this memoir.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. You began your wildlife biology master's degree, I'm jumping a little bit ahead, this wolf recovery work at the North Fork of the Flathead River along the northwestern boundary of Glacier National Park. For those of our listeners who are uninitiated, what was the North Fork like at that time? Place us on that landscape.
Wow. Well, I tell you, I drove out in a little car with everything I owned from Minneapolis, where I grew up, to the North Fork of the Flathead. And I thought, my God, I've just driven up 60 miles of gravel, dirt hole, pothole road. And I thought, I reached the end of the world here. And it was remarkable. I'd never seen any place so beautiful and so wild.
Mm-hmm.
So picture driving up one of the worst roads you've ever been on for 2.5 hours to start with. And then you arrive at the road that goes to the Canadian border. And it's log cabins, it's rustic old turn of the century, you know, 1900 turn of the century, homestead cabins. It was an interesting mix of characters. Back when I first got there in 79, it was loggers and homesteaders and hideaway hippies that want to live in the woods. It was just this interesting mix of people and political views, and yet it was still a community.
Yeah. And very few wolves, if any.
Yes, there was a lot more people than wolves that we had. When I first arrived there in the fall of 1979, there was actually one wolf.
Mm-hmm.
We captured her, put a radio collar on her, named her Kishnina.
Mm-hmm. She's a wolf that maybe we should introduce our listeners to now. Tell us about this lone wolf at the North Fork.
The first wolf we put a radio collar on was named Kishnina. She was a beautiful silver-gray female, middle-aged, young to middle-aged. She came from we don't know how far north, but they had done a huge extirpation campaign in southern British Columbia and Alberta along the Rocky Mountains in the 60s. And so there really was this wolfless band. So whether Kishnina came down from Banff or Jasper or points beyond, we don't know, and we didn't have the DNA ability to check it back then. So she came a long way, and she found her home in the North Fork of the Flathead, mostly on the Canadian side. She had a few tiptoes down into Glacier Park in the North Fork and eventually made it more of her home range. But she was unseen, mysterious, secluded, lone, and just trying to figure out life in the North Fork of the Flathead. And the lucky thing for her was the community was pretty receptive to her being there. There weren't conflicts. There was only a couple of people that had a small amount of livestock. And there was plenty of game, and people just thought she was novel back mm-hmm. then.
Yeah, I imagine she was novel. She was a single lone wolf on the landscape. She, and you credit her in the book, you use the word recolonize, but she, you credit her as being this wolf that helped or certainly catalyzed wolf recovery in the West, in Montana. Why did her recolonizing story, why isn't that the story that people know about? People know about Yellowstone. They know about these big, what you call and what we know as reintroductions of wolves to the West. Why don't we know about this single wolf, this recolonizing lone wolf?
That is a great question. And that is the crux of why I wrote the book. So as we were the Wolf Ecology Project, based under Bob Rehm here at the University of Montana, and Mike Fairchild and I were co-directing, and a whole bunch of endless stream of volunteers who were really working for nothing and worked really hard, and they were fabulous. But we were monitoring that wolf recovery from Kishnina, and eventually 2 years later, a male came down, and they made it, and they produced the first pack. And we published papers as we went along in the scientific journals, and there was some news in the local papers, but it was pretty much unheralded and unprecedented. You got to remember, there's no wolves except anywhere, you know, except the Midwest.
Right.
And she came down on her own, and there was no fanfare. There wasn't, you know, government agency people carrying in steel crates with wolves. It happened on its own through natural dispersal. And it's a really different story. And I think it's really important for the listeners to understand the difference in terms between reintroduction and recovery and recolonization.
Let's talk about those differences. Go ahead and define those for our listeners, because as you said, there's a very distinct difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So most people, 99.9% of the population of the U.S. at least, thinks of wolves as through reintroductions. And they happened in Yellowstone and central Idaho for the Rocky Mountain wolves, as well as the Mexican wolves and the red wolves. But we're just going to talk about the Rocky Mountain wolves. But they didn't, so these wolves were brought down from Canada, held in place or dumped out, depending on the location. And they kind of jump-started the process. But in the meantime, these original hardy colonizing dispersing wolves came down on their own naturally without anybody bringing them here from Canada. And by the time those wolves were reintroduced into Yellowstone and Idaho, we had 8 packs already, a few dispersers. There's probably about, I think, documented 75 wolves before any wolves were introduced. So they were making their way down. We already had wolves here in the 9 Mile from Missoula. They came from Canada. Some of them, one of the collared ones, I collared in Glacier. So the story was unfolding slowly, but there wasn't a lot of to do about it, even though we were publishing and there were small articles. It just wasn't promoted like the fanfare with the reintroductions.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, and so at least for me, hearing these stories, this is brand new. I've heard about the Yellowstone reintroductions for such a long time. And like you said, this was covered in the news all over. You know, it was very splashy news. This was, it was new to me. And it was novel, but also really, really lovely. Diane, let's talk about the minutiae of wolf repopulation in the West. This memoir, this book really dives into or centers wolf recovery. What does it mean to recover a species? What is the benchmark when it comes to numbers? What exactly are we talking about when we say wolf recovery?
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the federal agency that oversees the Endangered Species Act, and how states manage their populations requires recovery plans by each state. And if the recovery plan doesn't meet Fish and Wildlife Service's requirements, they don't get to manage their wolves. So, but each state has a plan. And in Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming together, it was determined by scientific experts that jointly those three states, if they had a population of 300 wolves or 30 breeding pairs, a breeding pair being two adults and two surviving offspring, that's a pack. If they met that for three consecutive years, it's a lot of math, but then they could be delisted. Well, that worked pretty well as wolves are coming back, but Wyoming's plan that they wrote didn't meet with the Fish and Wildlife Service's blessings. And so Wyoming was sitting off on the sidelines, and Montana and Idaho together, the state said, hey, you know what, we'll pick up Wyoming's wolves because we want to see them delisted so we can manage this species. So we'll take 300 wolves split between two states. And Fish and Wildlife Service says, yeah, we can do that. So we met that requirement, oh my goodness, long ago, almost 20 years ago. And they weren't delisted until about 2009 the first time. They were relisted in 2010. They were delisted in 2011. I mean, this, you can go through, it's like watching a tennis match for the listings, relistings, delistings everywhere. But that's basically what it means to be delisted under the guidelines of the Endangered Species Act here in the Rocky Mountains.
You're talking about kind of this tennis match or this ping-ponging between listing and delisting. It is such a political game, and there are people who want them delisted. There are people who don't. I want to go back to my first question, Diane. I asked you about the landscape onto which these wolves were being recovered, repopulated. How has this ecosystem, the North Fork, or if you even want to talk broadly, how has the ecosystem changed since wolves have become reintroduced and become an embedded part of it?
The landscape when the wolves first started coming down, Kishnina and her mates and her offspring subsequently, and then there were more breeding pairs, there wasn't much livestock where they lived, and there weren't many wolves, so hunters weren't too concerned. And I am a hunter. I harvest and have eaten a lot of wild game in my years. And so there wasn't this big problem. And when wolves began getting to areas where there were livestock, on the Rocky Mountain front, Mount Marion, down in Bass Creek.
Right, the Bitterroot.
Mm-hmm. In the Bitterroot, yeah. There started to be conflicts a little bit, but it was still pretty low level. And the Fish and Wildlife Service wanted to be sure to manage things well enough to minimize conflicts, and they were still fully endangered. The difference happens when you reintroduce a species, they're classified different. They lose a status as an endangered species and are classified as non-essential experimental. And with that goes the 10J rule, and there's a lot of legalese there, but it allows managers, federal state managers, to remove wolves that are causing problems. So the wolves that came to Montana were fully protected, and those that got reintroduced lost that protection. There was protection, but at a lower level.
That seems really complicated, not only for the animals onto which this kind of human system and these human laws are placed, but also around the discourse. Like, no wonder the public maybe didn't know about Kishnina. Like, it seems a little complicated when you talk about the difference between a recolonized wolf pack or a reintroduced wolf pack and what those laws actually mean. No wonder no wonder things got a little wishy-washy.
Oh, yeah. And it's geographic boundaries. I mean, wolves don't know what geographic
boundaries. Yeah, there's no boundaries.
So, like, the 9-mile pack is right on the boundary, the I-90.
Mm-hmm.
And so when wolves from the 9-mile would be north of the freeway, they would be fully endangered. And if they crossed south, which they did, they would suddenly become non-essential experimental. Same animal, but they crossed a geographic boundary, go back and forth. It's kind of crazy.
You're listening to A Conversation with Diane K. Boyd. I'm Lauren Korn. This episode of The Right Question is supported by Chapter 1 Bookstore in Hamilton, Montana, a literary and community resource for the Bitterroot Valley. providing space to explore, discover, and share passions since 1974. More information can be found at chapter1bookstore.com. I want to talk a bit about the way that wolves are talked about and how that discourse affects and certainly affected their recovery. If wolves can be maligned by ranchers but heralded by wildlife biologists, then the language that we use inevitably has a lasting emotional effect on the way we view them and on the relationship we have with or to them. And I suppose I mean that politically, socially, and environmentally, Diane. You write at one point in a chapter about Sage, a large male wolf who you freed from a trap, quote, "As a biologist, I relay Sage's story at the risk of appearing sentimental. But as the famed evolutionary biologist Stephen Jay Gould so eloquently put it, quote, we cannot win this battle to save species and environments without forging an emotional bond between ourselves and nature as well, for we will not fight to save what we do not love. And wolves have definitely snagged my heart." That's your heart, Diane. Why, in your experience, is sentimentality something that is risked and not embraced, particularly in the worlds that you inhabited or inhabit as a biologist?
As a trained professional biologist or scientist, we are taught to remain removed, that you look at the animal as a population of wolves. You don't look at the Sage and the Phyllis and the individual animals.
Right.
I talk about a couple of them in depth in my book. But you can't help but learn through the individuals. And when those individuals are killed, you can't help but have feelings about it, right?
Yeah.
But as a professional, like if I heard one of my wolves was shot up in Alberta or something, the game warden call because the number would be on the inside of the radio collar. And I would go up there every chance I got to meet the hunter. I would want to know the story of how they were able to shoot the wolf. And I would bring them the data about that individual animal. Rather than be mad or angry or sad, I wanted information. And I always felt if we had a good exchange, maybe that person would feel more interested in wolf conservation. And the people I spoke with weren't wolf haters, because the wolf haters just shoot, shovel, and shut up, and you never hear it. You don't get the collar back for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but these people were hunters. It'd be like somebody going out and harvesting, you know, and shooting a trophy bull elk or a trophy, I'm not a trophy hunter, trophy mountain lion. I'm not a trophy hunter, I'm a meat hunter. But for some of these people I talked with, shooting a wolf, although I don't want to shoot a wolf, but shooting a wolf for them was somehow a really enriching life experience as a hunter. And it's a different mindset than what you hear about now.
Hmm.
Now people shoot them because they hate them a lot.
Right, that aforementioned fear and kind of
fearful
or maligned discourse around them.
Yeah, and while I don't understand the reasons for shooting wolves, and I always ask, and when I worked for Fish, Wildlife, and Parks and I had to check animals in on the tailgates and I checked mountain lions and, you know, wolves and martens and whatever came in for bears, I always asked a story. And I don't understand, but I happen maybe think that when somebody sees a beautiful animal, I don't care if it's an elk or a moose or a wolf or a lion, perhaps when you take it, it becomes part of your story and perhaps somebody feels they connect better with the wild. I don't know. Like I said, I don't have those feelings, but perhaps that's what it is. I don't know. The one thing that I find if redeeming about is it these people who feel this way have a value on the wolf that's positive. So I feel strongly that to have an animal or a plant or a fish or whatever in our world nowadays, it has to have a positive value. If we don't value it, but like what Stephen Jay Gould said,
right,
we don't want to see it continuing because it might be a conflict, it might be a nuisance, it might be a skunk. I mean, whatever it is, you know, if it has a negative value, it doesn't hang around very well. You know, we tend to get rid of those things. So, and wolves have many different values. You have academic research value. You have aesthetic value. Like maybe somebody in New York City will never see a wolf in their life, but they love the fact that they know that it's out there and they get great pleasure for that. It might be a hunter who wants to have a trophy mount or something. It might be wolf watchers in Yellowstone. It might be a Native American who has some kind of a spiritual, but as long as it has a value, they will want to continue to see wolves in the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
And then some people have a negative, a lot of people have a negative value on the wolves and they just want them gone.
Right.
That's what I don't like to see.
Hmm. Especially when that negative value has been reinforced by certain cultural stories, political stories that really don't ring true on the ground.
Yes. I mean, the only reason wolves were extirpated was because of the social factor, the political. And the only reason they were back today is because of political values. It's not ecological. Wolves historically had the widest range distribution globally of any mammal except for humans. They lived in every habitat, every biome, except not south of the equator much, except for the Ethiopian wolves. But they live everywhere. They're habitat generalists, they're prey generalists, as long as they have large four-legged animals to eat. So they do well until we decide that they're not to be tolerated anymore. And we're pretty effective at wiping them out.
That's so interesting to say that it's a political idea and not an ecological idea. When wasn't it the reintroduction of wolves into places like Yellowstone that helped curb other populations, like elk populations? Is that true?
Depends on your values.
See,
you're a hunter, you say, yeah, those dang wolves, they killed off my elk.
Right.
And if you're a ecology-oriented person, you say, oh my goodness, thank goodness those wolves came in and knocked some of the elk back because they were starving every winter and they had late-season hunts to kill off extras and they paid sharpshooters, you know, in the 60s and 70s to kill some of the game. And so it really is a value.
It is a
value. It's not ecological.
Thing. Yeah. You've included a chapter about wolves and fear in this book. Feels part and parcel of this conversation that we're having about discourse and language. Will you talk, Diane, about the way that education and outreach plays a role in your environmental ethic and how you approach conversations about wolves? This is one conversation we're having. You've had many along your book tour.
Yeah.
Talk about that outreach and that education.
Okay. And one of the terms that I'll just qualify a little bit is the term education, because I find often, especially state agencies, that we're going to do public education, we're going to educate people. And I find it a little arrogant. And I have found in my years that the education is a two-way street. I get educated by the local people, and they can learn from me. But I don't like the word, but it's hard to think of a better phrase. But outreach is definitely important. And the most important thing, more important than education and outreach, is just listening. I can't tell you how many times I have had my hind end whittled down to tiny little size by people having to vent about wolves. And after just listening for a bit, and I can interject a few facts, then you find at some point where they're done. And then you can begin having a conversation. And the one common denominator might be it might take a while to get there. For example, if you're dealing with livestock growers, sometimes the only common value we have is they don't want their cows killed by wolves, and I don't want their cows killed by wolves. They don't want their livelihood lost, and I don't want to see wolves killed. So we have a common point. And it's often the only common point. So we start the conversation there. And then we figure out, well, what can we do to minimize those wolves kill on your livestock? Maybe there's aversive conditioning you can do. Maybe there's different kind of grazing management. Maybe you got a rogue wolf that's just got to kill livestock and that wolf has to be removed. There's a lot of solutions once you can get to the conversation point. But if you just go in there like, hey, I'm going to save you from the wolves. Well, the door is shut. I'm going to educate you about wolves. The door is shut. So that's, hopefully I answered your question.
You did, yeah. I want to take a step back and talk about you as a woman in this space. And in so doing, I want to step further back into your childhood. You write early on in your book in a chapter about growing up in Minnesota that when you were a child, you would beg your father to let you go hunting with him and your brothers. But it, quote, wasn't a thing in those days for girls to go hunting with the boys.
Right.
How did growing up alongside your brothers and with the father that you did prepare you for a career in wildlife biology? And I'm talking specifically, of course, about the dynamics between other wildlife biologists and a lot of the male-bodied figures that you found yourself among.
Well, I mean, I grew up in the 50s and, you know, early 60s is a different culture. But I'm very close to my brothers still. We converse, we travel together. I just came from Minnesota with a big family reunion, and we're very close. It didn't wear off on me as a bad thing. It just was the cultural norm. And my dad and I were very close. He's been gone a lot of years now, decades. But that I just sort of thought, okay, well, maybe when I get older. But it didn't change. But I was the one who'd sit there, and when they'd come home from Iowa or southern Minnesota with a trunk full of pheasants, I was the one who'd be playing with the legs and making the tendons pull and the foot flex and pulling out the tail feathers and playing with the wings. I was the biologist in the family. And as I grew older, my dad encouraged me to do whatever I wanted to do. Well, so did my mom for a career.
Mm-hmm.
And it was pretty obvious at a pretty young age that I was either going to be a veterinarian or some kind of a wildlife person or a, who knows. But
You tried your hand in the veterinary field that was how you started your studies, right? And
yes,
then you pivoted.
I started my undergraduate school in pre-veterinary medicine. I worked for a vet for a year, and I realized that that wasn't my calling. I needed something different. So. Mm-hmm. I kind of wove my path through a few different things and ended up in the wildlife management field and then into wildlife biology and had many great opportunities because I volunteered a lot
mm-hmm.
as a young person.
I don't know how else to ask this question, but what did it feel like to be a woman in those spaces, especially early on?
I get asked that question about being a woman in early days, and you know, I kind of just didn't really think about it because there wasn't the Me Too movement. There wasn't all this stuff going on. And I was always a bit of a tomboy. And I just put my head down and pushed harder. If there was a little wall put up in front of me, I'd put on my climbing spikes and I would go up over it. And it's just who I am. I'm a driven person. And so I really didn't think about it too much. In those early years. But it was pretty obvious. I mean, when I asked Dave Meach about when I was writing this book, I said, were there other women biologists doing what I was doing? And he said, nope, not at that time. There weren't women out there trapping and radio collaring and doing the field work. They were maybe assisting other people, but it wasn't done. Yeah. So I really didn't think about it a lot. I just did the job, and I'm not a whiner.
Well, I mean, I will point our listeners and you, Diane, to a certain point in the book wherein you're not amidst other biologists or managers.
That was Diane K. Boyd, author of A Woman Among Wolves, out now from Greystone Books. Diane holds a PhD in wildlife biology from the University of Montana. She divides her time between her home in Kalispell, Montana, and her beloved cabin on the North Fork. She is the author of numerous scientific papers on wolves. You've been listening to The Right Question. To listen to this conversation again or to share it with friends, head to mtpr.org. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Chris also engineered this episode. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.